From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Just before Al Gore announced he would not be a candidate for president in 2004, he vented to the New York Observer that he and his fellow Democrats couldn't get a fair shake from media increasingly in the pocket of Republicans. But Al Gore has been flogged by media across the political spectrum, as Paul Waldman documents in the latest issue of the liberal American Prospect. Case in point. In 1999, candidate Gore was asked by a student why young people should bother getting involved in politics. He answered that when he was in Congress, a high school student from the town of Toone, Tennessee, wrote him about pollution and high rates of cancer in her town. As a result, Gore said, quote, "I looked around the country for other sites like that. I found a little place in upstate New York called Love Canal, had the first hearing on that issue. And Toone, Tennessee, that was the one you didn't hear of, but that was the one that started it all." That's what he said, but that's not what many of us read in the papers. As Waldman notes, Catherine Seeley of the New York Times and Cece Connolly of the Washington Post reported that story.
And they misquoted him only with one word, but it was a critical word. They changed his statement that said that was the one that started it all, referring to this young girl in Toone, Tennessee, to I was the one that started it all, referring to himself and referring to Love Canal. And they made it sound as though Al Gore had claimed that he had actually discovered the existence of toxic waste at Love Canal.
And it really upset the students there.
It did. They issued a press release complaining about it. And I think one of the most critical things that happened is the next day, after Gore and his campaign complained about it, Cece Connolly wrote another article in the Washington Post, and the lead of the article was all about how Al Gore had made another verbal misstep. And she said the man who claimed to have invented the internet and been the model for the hero of love story now says he didn't quite mean to say he discovered toxic waste. So she constructed his protestations as almost as an admission that he had lied.
So are you saying then that Gore didn't say he invented the internet?
No, actually he didn't. What he said was, quote, "When I served in the Congress, I took the lead in creating the internet," unquote.
Oh.
Now, you can argue that that's an exaggeration of his role. If you talk to the people who were involved in the early days of the internet, they will tell you that among politicians, Gore was something of a visionary in this area. But he was clearly talking about his service in the Congress. He was not saying that he was down in his basement, you know, writing computer code and inventing file transfer protocol.
Oh, but he did say that the Ryan O'Neill character in Love Story was modeled after him.
This is another incident where it got distorted. He was on a plane or a bus with some reporters, and he was holding a newspaper where the paper said something about him and Tipper being the models for the heroes in Love Story. And he showed it to some other reporters and said, "Look at this. I didn't even know this." He went to college with the author, Eric Siegel. Eric Siegel came out and disputed some of the details in the story. It turned out he modeled the hero on Al Gore and his roommate in college, the actor Tommy Lee Jones. So all Al Gore did was point to a newspaper article. He never actually went around saying that he was the model for the hero in Love Story. And in fact, he was the model for the hero in Love Story.
After the high school students revealed that Cece Connolly had misquoted Gore, she argued that it didn't really matter. She wrote, and you quote her, saying, "We have an obligation to our readers to alert them that this continues to be something of a habit, that is to say, his lying." And long after the election, Connolly maintained incredibly that her misquote did not change the context of what Gore said.
Reporters come to a lot of conclusions based on kind of gut feeling and impressions and the kind of consensus they arrive at talking to each other. And those things then have to end up being translated into news, but they have to get pegged to some kind of an event. And so when she misheard him and thought he said I when in fact he said that, it played into the kinds of conclusions she had already made about who he was. So it was natural she would assume that it was important.
It's not completely unjustified that reporters suspect every new move from Gore to be a reinvention, because after all, he did enlist people like Naomi Wolf for his 2000 campaign makeover, and she told him to dress in earth tones to appear to be more the alpha male.
Right, but what happens is then that he ended up not being allowed to do almost anything that ordinary candidates are allowed to do. George Bush was allowed to change his clothes and go to some events in less formal clothing and to other events in more formal clothing. without any kind of comment about whether or not that meant that he was reinventing himself. But once the conclusion was made about Gore, he couldn't put on a casual shirt without comments about reinvention and what the symbolism of it was.
So your article suggests that Al Gore's bad treatment by the press was not the result of a right-wing conspiracy, but rather of an unfortunate political personality.
I think that's true to a great extent, but I also think even if he tried to make nice to reporters, one of the problems with having people conclude that you're a phony or a liar is that there's almost nothing you can do to change that opinion. If people think, as they did, for instance, with George W. Bush, that you're not too smart, well, you might be able to do something to show them that you, in fact, are pretty smart, and they might change their opinion. But if they think you're a phony, then they're going to be looking with a jaundiced eye at anything you do.
Well, Paul Waldman, thank you very much.
Thank you, Burke.
Paul Waldman is co-author of The Press Effect, Politicians, Journalists, and the Stories That Shape the Political World. His article appeared in the January 13th issue of The American Prospect.
On New Year's Day, the New York Times reported that Democrats felt outflanked by media pundits on the right. There's no shortage of conservative fire breathers on radio and TV, but where are their liberal counterparts? Why no Rush Limbaugh of the left? Alan Colmes, the designated liberal on Fox News Channel's nightly show Hannity and Colmes, thinks the answer has to do with the left's discomfort with broad-brush, broadcast-friendly analysis.
I think because conservatives had a tendency to look at issues in a very black and white way. They've done a very good job of reducing issues to bumper sticker mentality, and so the conservative message does very well within the confines of talk radio and television.
Let me ask you this. When I bite my lip and listen to Rush Limbaugh or some of the conservative voices on the Fox News channel, or when I read Ann Coulter or some of the more strident conservative voices the media have to offer, I can't help but noticing that a lot of the debate is through the prism of what the liberals have to say. There seems to be an obsession with liberalism and liberals to the exclusion of actual policy discussion.
They have made a living putting up straw men and saying, here's what a liberal thinks, here's what a liberal is, let's knock down this liberal. And they demonize people like when Nancy Pelosi was chosen to be House leader, she became characterized as a San Francisco liberal, which is code for a gay-loving left-wing lunatic. This is the politics of demonization, and it works very well. It's very entertaining, and it works very well in the medium.
So let's bring this back to you. You are the liberal side of the Hannity and Combs nightly confrontation.
Right.
And you're sitting there. I guess you're the human straw man, no?
Well, why are you insulting me? Because they try to make me a straw man doesn't make me a straw man.
I'm not insulting you. I want you to look at yourself in the dynamic that is created on Fox News Channel and in the Hannity and Combs program. Are you there from the perspective of the listeners as an equal to Sean Hannity, or are you a foil?
According to whom?
In the minds of the people who are watching the program.
Well, I'm not.
Let's just say most of the audience is conservative. Let's, for argument's sake.
I would concur that there are probably a large number of those people, because they automatically agree with Sean Hannity and automatically disagree with me. Many conservatives feel that for so many years their voice was not heard, and that to have a strong conservative voice on this medium encourages them and gives them hope that they previously didn't have. And some of them may view me as window dressing or think that I'm there simply as a foil, but that's their problem.
Well, then what's it like to go on the air every night knowing that the audience is predisposed to disregard whatever you say, no matter how well you say it?
Well, you made a monolithic comment. I think there's a large part of the audience that does not agree with me, and they're predisposed not to believe the things I say. But on the other hand, it's more fun for me to be in a situation like this and to preach to the choir.
Let's talk about radio now. Okay. Rush Limbaugh is a phenomenon, obviously. But there is no opposite number on the left. Do you think there is an opportunity there for someone like you to do what he is doing? Or do you think the dynamics just make it impossible?
Oh, I think there's definitely the opportunity for the right liberal host, whether it be me or somebody else. Now I think it's a really good time because you've got the conservatives in charge of all three branches of government. They run the courts, they run the legislative branch, they run the executive branch. And what better time to put on somebody who can push some of those buttons and stick pins in those balloons? After all, Rush rose to prominence when he was going against the Democratic Congress and later the Clinton administration. Is when you have the opposition, the loyal opposition, that I think there's a real opportunity, and I think that could be done very well.
All right. Well, we'll be listening for you. Alan Colmes, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Alan Colmes is the liberal half of Fox News Channel's Hannity and Colmes. So who will Rush to be the lefty Rush? One person thinking about it is humorist Al Franken, who believes the trick is not to be bombastic, but to be credible.
People on the left, liberals, don't want to hear simplistic demagoguery. They want to hear information. This is why NPR is accused of being liberal, because liberals listen to it. And liberals listen to it because you get a BBC report about what's going on in Afghanistan. And they don't want to hear Rush Limbaugh going like, there was not one iota of memorializing at the Wellstone Memorial, my friends.
Okay, so sometimes he's a little skimpy on the facts. That's true.
Oh,
are you suggesting that if were there a liberal counterpart to Rush Limbaugh who used the same techniques, they couldn't make it because the liberal mind, by its very nature, simply will not countenance such distortions and sophistry and trickery?
You put it very well. I really believe that.
So should you end up in the talk radio business, maybe.
Yes.
Where's your audience going to come from?
My audience is going to come. If I did this and I'm considering it, it would be a different kind of show. But I would definitely try to answer the Rushes and the Hannitys and those people and hopefully get an audience. But I won't do it. I refuse to do it by cheating and distorting.
If it's mostly true that the right-wing radio hosts and the Ann Coulters of the world are successful because they are spending most of their time reacting to the alleged bias of the leftist press, would a left-wing show talk about issues, or would it be obsessed with the right-wing media to the exclusion of actually discussing the news?
I would think that you would be able to. I would be able to talk about them in concert. In other words, I think it's not just the right-wing media that's lying. It's the administration.
Well, as you said, this is all strictly in the earliest stages. So let me just take this opportunity to wish you prospectively hypothetical good luck in the theoretical event that this ever takes place.
Well, I hypothetically thank you for your good wishes.
Al Franken is a humorist and author of Oh, the Things I Know, A Guide to Success, or Failing That, Happiness.
Coming up, digital armor, dubious football calls, and your letters.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. After years of battling copyright infringement in the courts, Hollywood, armed with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, is trying to turn the enemy's digital devices to its own advantage. The New York Times terms this new anti-theft technology digital armor. Hollywood studios call it digital rights management software. We have NPR's cultural trends correspondent Rick Carr here to tell us where this is all going. Welcome back, Rick.
It is always a pleasure. Brooke, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. So for those of us who are not experts, what exactly is new here?
What's new here isn't a whole lot in terms of the way we receive digital culture. I mean, DVDs from the time they came out a few years ago have had digital rights management built in. And the way you can tell is if you take a DVD and you put it into your computer and you try to copy what's on the DVD, your computer says, can't do it. That's a very simple form of digital rights management. What it does is it says you can't copy it onto your hard drive and then email it to your friends. Now, what Hollywood and the record industry are trying to do now is engage more complex digital rights management systems that would say, for instance, if you wanted to take a song off a CD and drag it onto your computer hard drive, a window would pop up that says, you actually don't have permission to do this. You didn't pay for this right. But if you give us $1.50 right now, we'll let you do it.
Okay, so what's wrong with that?
Well, effectively, what critics of the technology and the law say is that you have lost rights under this new regime of technology and law that you always had in the old world. The kinds of rights that we're talking about here are something known as fair use. The use is fair as long as it doesn't detract from anybody's ability to make money.
Aha, but the fact is, with digital technology and the ability to make incredibly high-quality copies, you can make money because you could potentially distribute it and sell it yourself over the net or in some other form, and that's precisely what these companies are worried about, and that's what these new technologies are about.
And that's exactly what the Hollywood studios and the record companies and, in fact, at this point, publishers are saying about the digitization of culture.
I want you to summarize for me some of these latest advances in the anti-theft technology that we've been reading about. Now, if you have certain kinds of high-tech plasma TVs, you can't watch certain HBO channels in the best format out of fear that you might be able to duplicate it. This is new. What else is new?
Well, effectively, what's new is that the technology has advanced to the point where instead of subscribing to cable and premium channels or a satellite system or going down to your local Blockbuster and renting or buying a DVD, you might be able to download a movie that lasts on your hard drive for 24 hours and then disappears. Now, that's attractive to the folks in Hollywood because they don't actually have to press a DVD. And there's no intermediary like Blockbuster to take some of the profit away or, in fact, to earn most of the revenue over the life of the DVD. There is some doubt about whether or not in the long run the technology is going to be effective. I mean, any time you put one of these sort of digital locks on something, there is somebody who's going to be able to pick the lock.
So we read recently in the New York Times that people who have very high-tech televisions and other high-tech equipment for bringing in complicated digital signals also have within that technology switches that Hollywood can use to prevent them from downloading or copying or even watching this material if Hollywood doesn't want them to. But when would those switches be thrown? What's the timeline?
The federal government has been trying to sort of mandate this transition to digital television, which is going to play a big role in this. But the federal government is trying to mandate that at a time when the economy has hit the skids. People don't have money to go out and buy $2,000, $3,000 digital television sets just because the federal government is mandating it. So there's a sense in Washington right now, as far as television goes, that the federal government's going to have to back off that.
Okay, so the transition will be slower than we thought. But the stage is set. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act protects Hollywood in the courts, and eventually its digital armor will defend it on the ground. Consumers eventually are going to have to pony up, probably a little more, but not a lot. Is this what the critics of digital armor are so upset about?
The critics of the technology and the law that backs it up say what we're doing with our culture as a whole with these technologies and this law to back it up is we're saying, Brooke Gladstone, you will never own anything again. Every time you want to hear your favorite song, you will pay for it. Every time you want to read your favorite novel, you will pay for it. And the question that they raise is, do we really want to live in a culture where access to the products of that culture is predicated on your ability to pay every time?
As always, it's fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Brooke.
Rick Carr is NPR's cultural trends correspondent and a contributor to PBS's Now with Bill Moyers.
The the debate over how to quench America's relentless thirst for oil, like many political arguments, is extremely polarizing, characterized by emotion, rhetoric, and lots of apparently conflicting statistics. But according to a new report by the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, there is reliable information to be had, at least when it comes to the amount of recoverable oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And according to the report, called Sorry, Wrong Number, those facts are being misrepresented by advocates on both sides of the drilling debate and in turn being misused by the media. Jonathan Coomey spearheaded the report. He is currently a staff scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley Lab. He says there are three ways to measure the oil in the Arctic Refuge, but in the debate over drilling, only one meaningful number.
You can look at it as how much oil is in place, you know, the absolute amount, and then you can look at how much can be extracted using current technology. Then you can look at how much of that that could be extracted can be extracted economically. And the one that is most relevant to the debate over whether or not to drill is how much oil is economically recoverable given the range of recent oil prices.
Okay, let's just stipulate for the moment that you're right about that, that that's the only relevant statistic. What has been reported around the country?
Well, what we found when we looked at 35 different articles was that a range of between 0 and 20 billion barrels of oil was reported as how much oil you could extract. And if you look at it in terms of economically recoverable oil, the range given recent oil prices is only between 0 and 5.6 billion barrels. And so what you had after looking at these different news reports, you had this impression that the actual amount of oil that would be economically recoverable is much, much higher than what the U.S. Geological Survey study said for economically recoverable oil.
Is the misreporting happening irrespective of the perceived political biases of the news organizations?
There's no obvious relationship between the amount of oil that was reported to be in the Arctic Refuge and the political orientations of the news organizations. They would go to advocates on both sides of the debate. And, of course, the advocates for drilling took estimates that made it seem like there would be a lot of oil, and the people who oppose oil drilling did the opposite. And so you had this interesting case where there's one source of the data, the U.S. Geological Survey, and the advocates on either side of the debate took the numbers that were most convenient for their case, and the media used the quotations from these different advocates instead of going back to the original source, and in the process of that created a misimpression because the range that was cited typically tended to overestimate the amount of economically recoverable reserves from the Arctic Refuge.
Well, this erratic behavior is kind of disturbing. What lessons can journalists draw from your study?
Number one, sometimes there are right and wrong answers. What tends to happen is that the media see this as, you know, there's a debate. There has to be two sides to this. Sometimes, though, in scientific literature, there are not two sides, and that's important for them to realize. Second, it's very important to go back to the original source. And the last key thing is make sure you get the definitions right. Make sure you're explaining exactly what the number is.
So in a funny way, actually, the journalist's laudable preoccupation with balance causes them to misrepresent truth.
In some cases, that's correct. Obviously, in political debates and so on, you need to make sure that all sides are somehow heard. But it is important to understand that in certain kinds of technical topics, there are right and wrong answers.
Jonathan Coomey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Coomey is a staff scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and author of the book Turning Numbers into Knowledge. That could sell up to somewhere between 0 and 20 billion copies in terms of copies sellable with current technology and available audience. I'm going to say that it's at the low end of that spectrum.
That's probably right.
And now for a few of your letters. We had an avalanche of mail related to last week's broadcast of our extended parody of public radio called Pledge This. The response, to our delight and surprise, was overwhelmingly positive. Frederick Welk of Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, called it brilliant, 4 stars for your send-up of public radio. My only worry is that the truth is probably stranger than your fiction. Charlie Brenner of Lexington, Massachusetts, wrote to congratulate us on a fine and funny bit of self-examination. On a less pleasant note, he added, referring to the character Trent Rosenblit, who had a chronic problem, I happen to be president of the American Nose Whistle Society. We are deeply concerned about your trivialization of this tragic condition. You'll be hearing from our lawyers, especially if you sit next to one of them at the movies. Stephen Gross of New York City wrote, I was laughing so hard that I had to stop my exercising until the skit was finished. I hope that we'll hear more of the ongoing adventures of WACLU every 6 months or so.
Well, Stephen, thanks, but that's not going to happen. Working on Pledge This nearly put our perfectionist production engineer Dylan Keefe into a coma. And the fact that Pledge This is unlikely to return certainly will please some of our listeners, including Joe O'Brien of San Francisco, who wrote, Pledge drives are more stimulating. Don't do that again. And Lincoln Potter of Seattle echoed the sentiments of several respondents when he wrote, Please, OTM, stop wasting precious airtime on this masturbatory pap. We need you. We depend on you to do your job. Like it or not, it is time for us to go back to work. Thanks for all of your letters. Keep them coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And please, don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
At the end of last Sunday's New York Giants-San Francisco 49ers playoff game, the officials made a mistake that cost the Giants a chance to win. But that wasn't the only blown call. Fox's TV color analyst Chris Collingsworth not only failed to point out the error, he also slammed the Giants' field goal holder for not immediately spiking the fumbled snap into the ground. That move, Collingsworth insisted, would have stopped the clock and allowed the Giants to try a potential game-winning kick. Wrong. It would have actually resulted in a penalty against the Giants and ended the game. Neither of his two colleagues on the broadcast corrected Collingsworth, nor did the Fox postgame show afterwards.
The folks at Fox, however, are not alone among TV broadcasters when it comes to having a somewhat tenuous grasp on gridiron rules and strategy. In fact, the only members of the press who get the full picture of what really goes on the field may be a small handful of men who gather every week during the season in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. In the midst of last year's NFL playoffs, OTM's John Solomon paid them a visit.
In a dimly lit room on the second floor of a South Jersey industrial park building, the leading scholars in the field sit before 2 27-inch TV screens. One of the men leans back on his chair, feet up on a desk, remote control in his lap. He aims an electric red pointer and announces preliminary findings to his colleagues.
They really haven't had a base defense. So the first thing I look at, what front did they play? 3 down linemen or 4 down linemen?
Ron Jaworski, former star quarterback of the Philadelphia Eagles, is a senior researcher in the Laboratory of the Edge NFL Matchup Show, which airs every football weekend on ESPN. In wire-rimmed glasses, Jaworski looks as professorial as possible for a man who stands 6'2", weighs over 200 pounds, and answers to the nickname Jaws. Studying the other screen is former Pittsburgh Steelers running back Merrill Hodge. A youngish, muscular 36-year-old, Hodgie looks more like a grad student. The duo has been called the Enrico Fermi and Wernher von Braun of football. Yet splitting the atom is nothing compared to figuring out how to stop the St. Louis Rams offense, the task Jaworski and Hodge contemplate now. By the end of the week, their assignment is to assemble a half-hour show previewing in detail how the teams playing during the coming weekend match up against each other. From their privileged position as the only members of the media who get full access to the actual game tapes here at NFL Films headquarters, the Edge team views angles that fans almost never see in their living room on Sundays. Unlike normal TV coverage, which just follows the ball with close-ups, this film captures the activities of all 22 men on the field.
I mean, right now, if I'm a coach, you're going absolutely nuts. You know, take this guy, you got outside, you got inside help, don't get beat to the outer or the corner. They're probably going over that for about 6 hours that week.
Greg Cosell has been the executive producer of the Edge NFL matchup since its launch in 1984, carving a niche for his show that no other football gabfest can claim.
Does the average viewer think that what he watches on Sunday gives him a very clear picture of the game? I would say they probably do.
But Cosell estimates that actually the television viewer only learns about 20% of what's really happening on the field. It turns out that the most revealing shots filmed on Sunday aren't shown on Sunday.
Unless you're watching this and have an understanding of what you're watching, you simply don't know exactly what's happening.
By Friday, Jaworski, Hodge, and Cosell will have scrutinized about 30 hours of game tape from the previous week. The obsessively analytic team also serves as something of an epicenter of knowledge from which other football punditry emanates. Sports talk show hosts and reporters from around the country jam the phone lines, interested in any new research breakthroughs. This morning, Jaworski had his brain picked live by Jody Mack and Sid on New York's WFAN. Hodge is now lecturing to Paul and Jeff from KFAN in Minneapolis.
I got you, man.
Is this St. Louis?
No, this is Minnesota.
Greg Cosell is the nephew of the late Howard Cosell. So he, more than most, is sympathetic to the demands on the announcers who call the games live. But he does acknowledge that the films they watch during the week often point out errors in the coverage over the weekend. For example, it is common for the announcers to tell the viewers that the quarterback didn't throw the ball because all the receivers were covered downfield. Yet Cosell says when they view the tape, they see that all the receivers are not necessarily covered downfield, up to 60% of the time. Every week, about 1.5 million viewers tune in for Edge's second draft of football history. Among the show's most loyal followers are the only others with access to the tapes, NFL coaches and players. One fan, Brian Billick, coach of the Baltimore Ravens, last year's Super Bowl champion, thinks the networks in the NFL understate the public's interest in the in-depth analysis now only seen on the Edge show.
It's in the best interest of the fans. It's in the best interest of the game.
And as the performance of Fox Sports at the end of the Giants-49ers game underscores, further studying the details of the game may also be in the best interest of football broadcasters. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
Coming up, the new Beverly Hillbillies are no joke, and what it means to be a victim of tragedy and the media.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In recent months, producers of an upcoming CBS series have been scouring West Virginia, Arkansas, and four other rural states looking for rubes. One lucky family will be uprooted from its home and transplanted to a Southern California mansion to have their every hilariously unsophisticated move and utterance videotaped for the show called The Real Beverly Hillbillies, a cross between the classic sitcom and MTV's Real World. Putting exhibitionists in degrading situations for the voyeuristic pleasure of the masses is nothing new. Think of Fear Factor, for example. But an organization called the Center for Rural Strategies is incensed about this one. Dee Davis is president of the Kentucky-based organization. Mr. Davis, welcome to OTM.
I'm glad to be here.
The network ignored your earlier protests, but now you've placed ads in major newspapers condemning CBS. Any reaction lately?
We haven't heard from them, and we didn't really expect to hear from them either. We just thought that we would let them hear from us for a while.
The network says that, we'll just play devil's advocate here for a moment, that the fish out of water scenario is time-honored in television, and if done properly with respect for the people involved, can be very amusing without being mean-spirited. Do you buy that?
They're referring oftentimes to fictional television shows like the old Beverly Hillbillies, where you had actors pretending to be characters or buffoons, and they went home every day to their home in Bel Air, and everybody was safe. This is something different. This is transporting a rural family and then laughing at them because they're poor.
CBS says this is all in good fun. Do you believe that, at least in its genesis, it wasn't really just all good, clean, wholesome fun?
Have you ever seen this videotape called Dancing Outlaw? This buck dancing, glue sniffing hillbilly who dances on a picnic table and dresses as an Elvis impersonator. Well, the guy who made that, Jacob Young, is the guy who they've signed on to be the director here. CBS at first, it was all about hick hunts and how funny it's going to be. But when people started to protest, they shut up. They shut down their hotline looking for nominations for families, and they let the production company take all the heat. But I think that their intent's pretty clear.
With other reality shows like Big Brother and The Bachelor and Joe Millionaire and Fear Factor that in one way or another put the participants in degrading situations. If you're going to be outraged, isn't it pretty much kind of like, well, take a number? Is the real Beverly Hillbillies likely to be any worse than the other reality fare that's already on television?
I suppose no one should hold out a lot of hope for television becoming uplifting. All we're saying is that there are some standards. You know, at one time, CBS was the Tiffany Network. They were the gold standard for family entertainment and news broadcasting. Where are those standards now? It's true that rural people may not be living as well as their metropolitan counterparts, but that gives CBS no license to laugh at them. And that's all we're saying. This is a step too far. That's all. We want CBS to come to their senses, you know.
All right, I have two more questions for you.
Okay.
The first one is, where were you when Jerry Springer was in his heyday and we really needed you?
I'm not as familiar with Jerry Springer as I probably should be.
Well, just to refresh your memory, he seemed to go into the, to the D counties and find the fattest, dumbest, dyed, hairiest morons that he could locate and have them bear their perversities for a live studio audience.
Well, I think sensitivities change, and I think that's not such a bad thing. As rural people, we can laugh at ourselves and we can take a punch. I guess the question is, why do we have to take so many of them? You know, there was a time when different things were funny. Just 100 years ago, 1906, the Bronx Zoo put an African tribesman in a cage with a parrot and an orangutan and had crowds file by to see him every day. African-American ministers in New York City protested to the mayor. The mayor wouldn't do anything. The brass at the Bronx Zoo wouldn't do anything. But at some point, you got to say, hey, wait, this is wrong. You got to stop.
Because in the end, fundamentally, it's West Virginians in the Bronx Zoo.
Because in the end, making fun of people because they're poor, it's not American, it's not appropriate, it's not ethical.
And now that final question I promised you. When the original Beverly Hillbillies was on TV, did you laugh?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I watched it. I was growing up in Hazard, Kentucky. It was about, I guess, as hillbilly as any place in the world, according to CBS. You know, maybe it hurt a little bit that a whole family is portrayed as being illiterate. But, you know, we can roll with the punches. I don't think any of us are so precious we can't afford to laugh at ourselves.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
D. Dee Davis is president of the Center for Rural Strategies, based in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
Later this winter, Allentown, Pennsylvania's daily newspaper, The Morning Call, will have another installment in its series called After the Media. In the series, reporters return to the victims of tragedy, scandal, and other media feeding frenzies so that they can describe the experience of being surrounded, trapped in the camera's lens. This is a unique endeavor, as far as we know. Journalist Margie Peterson is the person who came up with the idea.
The Morning Call had written in an editor's note when we began the series that the late pop culture artist Andy Warhol said in the future everyone would be famous for 15 minutes, but he never said how they would feel about it. And in the last couple of decades, there's been such a proliferation of media and cable news stations, talk radio, the internet, magazines, all looking for stories or commenting on existing ones. Our series was meant to explore what it was like to be in the center of a media storm, a feeding frenzy, especially for people who aren't accustomed to dealing with the press. So we wanted to look at what's it like, for example, to have to deal with the death of a child, which has to be the hardest thing in human experience, and have a bunch of reporters asking you questions at the same time. That was the intent of the series.
And basically what this series does is allows the people who are in the center of those media storms to finally have their say, to talk back to the media.
Yes, to talk about how the media affected them. Obviously, whatever happened to them, whether they were a victim of crime or a scandal or something along those lines, is going to affect them. But they also had so much press to deal with, and that had a great effect on them. And what they saw were the excesses of the press and reporters in general. I don't know any reporter that doesn't feel a little bit guilty about it.
I think you would have to be a cold-blooded Vulcan to not have any feelings about that. It's one of the things that the journalists hate most, going and talking to a family when they've lost a loved one. In fact, I think we should probably put a moratorium on it. I mean, anything that you get that day is usually not very helpful anyway. And I think it might be better for the readers and for the family and for our image if we let them have their space.
Mike Frassinelli writes for The Morning Call and in particular has written several installments of After the Media. As you proceed, as you follow the stories of people who have been victims of the media in the midst of their own tragedy, does After the Media serve a purpose for you, a feeling that justice is finally being done?
Well, it was definitely an eye-opener. The part about the Griders, they're a family who lost their daughter in a murder at one of our local universities. The father said that the reporters were assembled outside his door, and he didn't know what to say to them.
Mrs. Grider, the mother of Jennifer Grider, who was killed, said that she was at the funeral, and reporters were everywhere, and cameras were everywhere, and there wasn't a moment's peace. When she went into the funeral, when she went out, people were looking at her, waiting for her to cry, and she was very conscious that. One of the things she said was that one of our reporters had taken a photo of her daughter, Jennifer Grider, and promised to guard it with his life and then never returned it. And that kind of thing, I think, when a reporter reads these stories in this series, I'm hoping they make mental notes to say, I will never do that. You know, I will understand what this photo means to this family, and I'll make sure it gets back to them.
Well, how has it changed the way you do your job?
Well, we have kind of an unusual occupation. We step in and out of all these different lives. And when we finish our story, a lot of times we just wipe our hands clean of it and go on to the next story. And a lot of times we don't think about what we left behind. And I think that's definitely caused me to think a little bit more about what we left behind.
Margie Peterson came up with the idea of the After the Media series for The Morning Call in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Mike Franzinelli writes regularly for the series. One reason, probably the main reason, that there is such blanket coverage of personal tragedy and mayhem is that we human beings cannot help but care about it. We watch in horror as reporters are dispatched in battalions in pursuit of the bereaved, and yet we somehow want them to be there.
I remember very well when the Lockerbie tragedy happened, and the video of the one mother, which showed her on the floor of the airport in New York, crying uncontrollably upon learning that her daughter was on that flight. The video I saw is heart-wrenching. At the same time, as intrusive as it is, to me, that particular piece of video was the wailing of a nation.
Bob Steele is a specialist in the ethics of journalism at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. He coined the term for what some reporters now call the bummer beat.
Many journalists tell me that they will go out to the home of somebody whose family has been part of a tragedy, and they'll drive by the house 5, 6, 7, 8 times and not stop, and instead drive down to the corner and put a quarter in the payphone and call back to the office and tell their editor or news director, nobody was there, I guess we don't have a story.
But in the end, Steele believes that, however unpleasant, telling these stories is important.
Journalism plays an important role in painting a picture to allow the public to experience both the joys and the sadness of what life is about. It is one of the most difficult jobs in a newsroom to cover tragedy, and it is a responsibility that challenges journalists to be their very best when they have to do it.
Reporter Suzanne McCarroll at KCNC-TV in Denver knows how to do it. She's on what amounts to permanent assignment to the bummer beat. She believes in the power of the survivor's perspective. She sees the sharing of it as a gift.
You know, a lot of times we treat them like, you owe us an interview, and that's so untrue. They're inviting us into their homes to talk about personal things, and that's a privilege. You know, the Constitution doesn't guarantee us the right to get interviews with people going through tragedies, and a lot of times we act like it's our journalist-given right, and we don't afford them the opportunity to say no.
Many years ago, McCarroll did a story that she says she'll never forget that hurt the participants. She said it changed the way she worked. She's careful about the way she portrays the victims of tragedy. She approaches them gently and with apologies. When possible, she'll drop a note at the door. She'll get the facts right, the names, the ages, the jobs, the photographs the family prefers. And she'll never ask, how are you feeling?
I ask the simple question, how are you doing? I mean, how are you feeling is such a silly question. They've lost a loved one. Of course they're feeling lousy. So how are you doing can afford them the opportunity to talk about, you know, how they're coping with the tragedy and how they go on from there.
Rebecca Oakes is now a victim's advocate with the Denver District Attorney's Office. But she's a victim, too, marked permanently in December of 93, when an angry ex-employee took aim at the staff of a suburban Chuck E. Cheese restaurant.
He waited until all the customers were gone. He came out of the bathroom and just systematically shot everyone who was there. He shot, Ben, and Ben died. He shot Colleen, and Colleen died. He shot Sylvia. Sylvia died. He shot Bobby, who lived, and he shot my mom, who also died.
Rebecca Oakes found her misery compounded by an overzealous press.
There's a gag order on the case because of the publicity surrounding it. The only information that we really had was that my mom was shot in the head. Probably about 2 months after this happened, I opened up the paper one day and saw that she was shot twice in the head, once in each ear, from a distance of no more than 6 inches away. And reading that in the paper, I felt like it was happening all over again. I felt like I was going to faint. I felt like I was going to throw up. And more than anything, I was furious.
Family members, she says, don't want to get information like that in the newspaper without warning. Some family members, she says, would skip the paper that day if they knew. The public might wonder why a person in Rebecca Oakes' situation would subject herself to the media at all. She did because she, like many survivors, wanted the world to recognize her loss.
It always irritated me that the papers would always say, Nathan Dunlap shot and killed 4 people. And I always wondered why they didn't say, some guy shot and killed Marge Kohlberg, Ben Grant, Sylvia Crowell, and Colleen O'Connor. There's a great need to let people know about my mom. I mean, you hear about murders all the time, and you don't know the people, so it doesn't really affect you. Well, if you know something about those people, I think that you're going to think about it a little bit more.
Yeah, I used to pride myself on knowing every homicide case in Miami. And, of course, one year we had 637.
That's Edna Buchanan, a journalist devoted to the reporting of mayhem, who spent 18 years with the Miami Herald. When she returned from out of town, she would check on the murders she missed.
And one was the murder of this young man who lived with his grandmother. And I happened to find myself in that neighborhood, and I stopped by, knocked at the door, and she opened it, and I introduced myself and said I wanted to talk to her about her grandson. And she took a deep breath, stepped back, threw the door open wide, and invited me in, and she said, I wondered why nobody came.
Buchanan always knew she was calling a person in pain. She also knew that for many of them, there was only one brief moment to tell their story as reporters rushed past yesterday's tragedies in pursuit of tomorrow's. She developed this approach. She'd call once. If they hung up, she'd count to 60 and call again. More than half the time, they would want to speak on the second attempt. She would never call a third time. In 1981, she had 637 families to call.
My goal that year was to get every single case, every single victim into the paper. At the end, I'm convinced I was sort of shell-shocked and numb. But I did it, and I thought it was important because we're all in trouble when these victims begin to just be statistics, to be numbers. It's so important to have them stay in our consciousness to make us all aware of what's going on and who they were.
Any one of us could be a family member at an airport hotel, submerged in sorrow, spied through the looking glass of a camera lens.
My mother's dead.
Yeah, she must
explain. I'm one of those people now who everybody else is watching and saying that poor person.
Edna Buchanan says those people are us. After more than a decade on the bummer beat, Suzanne McCarroll says every day brings a constant reminder of her own loved ones safe at home. When a survivor talks to the media, they not only share their sorrow, they remind us all to take nothing for granted.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Megan Ryan and Emily Ford, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the show and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support from the media is provided by the Bydell Foundation, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.